Everyone, good morning to everybody. We're here for adult Bible study, and I'm going to continue in this series. I've called Faith and Freedom. Why I've called it that, I hope will become more apparent in a few weeks down the road. Because I'm going to tie this back to human government, how we govern ourselves in the United States, things like that later on. But last week, I did a lesson on ethics. As long as I have been going to church, I've never heard a lesson on ethics in that sense of kind of formalizing things. But I did it because I wanted to ask difficult questions today and maybe next week. We'll see how far we get. And try to make sure that we push ourselves beyond political answers and deal with Bible answers. Because at the end of the day, I made a decision a long time ago that the Bible is actually true, completely true, without any exceptions. And if its truth is in contradiction to a political platform, I'm going to stick by this period. And I think too often those distinctions have gotten blurred. And so we have quick political answers to questions like, is it appropriate for the government of the United States or the government of Texas to kill its citizens? I don't care about political. I care about Bible. And is it appropriate for the United States to send young men and women into war in a foreign country and have them kill people they don't know? But don't take by my asking the question that I'm giving you an answer. I'm just saying these are hard questions, and if you give a political answer, frankly, for a Christian, that's not good enough. We need to have a Bible answer, or at least a Bible approach. And they're not easy questions, because really part of the response ought to be, it depends. It depends on a lot of things. But I want to start with an easy example, but not an easy issue. And this matter of telling the truth. That'll be the first thing on this handout. Let me just note, by way of housekeeping, because I forgot to do this before. It's not very printed very darkly, but the bottom of the handout is a web address. I usually record our lessons and I post them there at that web address. On the bottom of the page, and I post a PDF of the handout so you could get it, and it's actually in color and looks way better than what I printed, but it cost me like $1 a page to print color ones. So you can see it in color. And that takes you to everything that I've recorded since like 2008. You can select sermon series, and you would just select Faith and Freedom, okay, the current series. Or if you wanted the stuff we did on the book of Acts before this, the book of Acts was called Jesus Builds the Book of Acts, and you select that, and it would have everything. If you select the Chapel Hill Bible Fellowship series, you'll have videos, at least going back for most of this year, I think, of everything. And you can get it on our YouTube page as well for the church, but you'll have Mel's sermons, mine, Joe's, I mean, yours is on there, I'm pretty sure. I mean, everything that's been done. Yeah, so it's a place of keeping that. I'm also going to post, if I can, on that on the website with this lesson, this lengthy technical paper, and I couldn't make a bunch of copies for it. It was just too long. But if you're interested in a lengthy technical paper on capital punishment, lengthy, just like 10 pages, it'll be there from my perspective, and I'll talk a little more about that later. So I just want to review one concept from last time. We talked about different ethics systems. One is relativism. You can have your truth, your sense of what's morally right. I have mine, and you can't tell me mine is inferior to yours, unless I'm a Christian, of course. And then we have ethical egoism, which is I should just always do what's in my best interest. That's everybody knows someone like that. We usually call them narcissists. Everything is for them. Or we call them toddlers, right? But that's what defines right. And then we have emotivism. If it feels right, then it's acceptable. And our culture moves in that way. People, you'll say, that's wrong. They say, yeah, that feels right to me. So we have these different views. But within Christianity, we have something called absolutism, but there's some variations. Absolutism is the idea that I have a fixed transcendent standard either in the Word of God or maybe some other source. If you were Islamic, you might say my fixed standard is the Quran. But that becomes what helps you discern good from evil, right from wrong. And within Christianity, there would be an absolutism that says anytime you violate the Scripture, it's sin. So you have to look at the Scripture and nothing else. But you would have a graded absolutism that would say sometimes you're put to a choice between two options that are both sin. You should pick the one that's the least sin, if that makes sense. In other words, you would pick to lie instead of picking to murder or to allow someone else to murder. So both of those are sin. You've sinned by lying. You sin by telling the Gestapo there's no Jews hidden in your home, but you avoided the greater sin of allowing them to be killed. And then there would be a version of absolutism that would say kind of the same thing, except in that instance, it was okay to lie because you saved a life. Okay? And so those are sort of the views that are out there. I'm not going to tell you which one to accept. You come to your own convictions. But that ought to guide how we deal with these issues. So I want to read something from Exodus 1 to give us a moral question to answer. And I remember years ago hearing a sermon on the passage I'm going to read. And I remember the pastor starting off saying, "Does anyone know who Pua and Shipra are?" And I mean, there were only about 1,500 people there. I think there were three or four hands raised. I didn't have a clue who Pua and Shipra are, but God did. Look at what he says about these ladies. Starting in verse 15 of Exodus 1, the king of Egypt, otherwise known as Pharaoh, the king said to the Hebrew midwives, "The first, whose name was Shipra, and the second, whose name was Pua." Incredible, that little bit of detail is given, because these ladies are held out as women of tremendous courage in the Bible. And the government, it could have been the U.S. of A government, the Republic of Texas government, the government of Egypt, doesn't matter. They told these women what to do, and I've got to submit to government, except they didn't, and God blessed them for it. So think about that. It enters a little monkey wrench into our thinking sometimes. Here's what Pharaoh said to them. "When you help the Hebrew women give birth, observe them as they deliver. If the child's a son, kill him. But if it's a daughter, she may live." The midwives, however, look at that word, feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt had told them. They let the boys live. So far, so good. So the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and asked them, "Why have you done this and let the boys live?" And listen to their response in verse 19. "The Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife can get to them." the Jewish women give birth faster than the Egyptian women. We just never make it until after that boy's, you know, already out and in mama's hands or whatever. So God was good to the midwives. Wait, they lied. God was good to the midwives. "And the people multiplied and became very numerous. And since the midwives feared God, he gave them families." Now, if you take and again, I'm not telling you what to think. I just want you to be pushed a little on this. If you take an absolutism view that's just unconditional, it's just, you know, if you lie, it's a sin. You have to deal with the question of why, in this instance, God not only seemingly approved, but blessed them for it. That's, I mean, it's just right there in the text. So tell me what you think. Was it a sin for the midwives to lie to the Pharaoh, or was it not? Right? What do you think? A white lie. That's a good one, and that's a good answer too. Because the very fact that our culture has the concept of a white lie tells you just about all you need to know. A white lie is supposed to be a little lie, right? It's not a bad lie. You were asked if you ate the last remaining bowl within the cup or the container of Bluebell. And the white lie, I have no recollection of that. Sounds presidential. I have no recollection of the last bit of ice cream at the bottom of the carton of Bluebell. White lie. What else?
Maybe he was better telling the truth. Maybe Hebrew women are poor people. Yeah. And babies were born before.
See, right, I hear you. Maybe they were telling the truth. Seems unlikely, right? Plus, you know, we also have this thing of when you, and this is recognized in the legal system, right? You can have an outright lie. Sometimes you can have a lie by omission, but that's only when I actually have some reason, some duty, I've got to tell you something. But then you have that place in the middle, and that's where it's half a truth. That ice cream was empty the last time I looked at it. Right? It is, but it's a half a truth because it's misleading. So we can come up with these ways to maybe wiggle out of it. What do you think? Was it a lie? And we could throw into the group into the story. Was it a lie for Rahab to tell the king of Jericho that the spies had already left and run off the other way when she knew they were on the roof of her house hiding under some flax? She saved their lives. What was God's response to her lie? Yes, sir.
I would say it was a lie, but the intent.
Yeah, that's an important distinction, right? It is a lie, but it has an intent. And what's the difference, right? Because usually, why would I usually lie to somebody? I want to shape your view. I want to manipulate your thinking about something, but often for my personal benefit. So what about this intent makes it different?
I think Pharaoh underestimated mother's love for her child.
Well, he did. And these midwives who were Jewish as well, who would have... I mean, they are risking their lives, right, by lying to him and by saving the children in the first place. And in Rahab's case, in this case, and when Corrie ten Boom and her father and her sister protected hundreds of Jewish people from execution who hid in their house in Holland, they lied. Betsy didn't, actually. I mentioned that a week ago. But one time the troops came in and she actually said, we've hidden them over here. And like, absolutely, it was the truth. And they disbelieved her and left. They like thought it was, you know, a joke or something. But all of them lied with the intent of saving somebody's life, not with the intent of manipulating somebody for their own benefit. Now, I don't know whether that matters. Because, you could come up with examples that don't involve somebody dying. Yes, ma'am.
What matters is if they put God's law over man's
law. Yes. God's law over man's law. And that's an important principle. And we're gonna talk, and like I say, we may not get through this whole thing because even this first one's a big bite to chew. But when I talk about capital punishment, we'll go to like Romans 13 where you're told to obey the government. 1 Peter, obey the government. And lots of politically conservative people really like that. I mean, that's, you know, and I get it. I'm just, we'll stir the pot some more. But do you always obey the government, no matter what? Just because it'll say God has ordained human government, like He did, and Paul will talk about being submissive to it. But is it always? Can we think of other biblical examples where people did not submit to the human government and seemingly were approved by God? We have a great one here in Exodus 1. God doesn't even mention the lie. He just says, yay you, in essence, I'm going to bless you with families. You'll have children. Other examples where people defied human government.
Daniel.
Yeah. How did Daniel defy human government? It's in the first chapter of the book, right? Young teenager.
Except
he's not recorded at the scene with the bowing down, but his friends wouldn't bow down, right? In Daniel 2. And so they or Daniel, maybe it's Daniel 3 where the statue actually gets built, but they wouldn't bow down. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would not bow down to the statue of, you know, more or less the Babylonian Empire, the golden statue. And they were ordered to do it or they would die. And they stuck by that all the way to being inside the fiery furnace, right? So that's an example. And what about Daniel in chapter 1?
He wouldn't eat the food.
Right. The king said, just think about this. We talk like a white lie. This is a white sin. The king says, here is a slow roasted prime rib, that little bitty a container of the au jus to pour over it, and some sweet rolls and a baked tater. Okay, and he wouldn't eat the prime rib. He said, "Give me some broccoli and some asparagus, and you know, how big of a sin would it have been? Just eat the prime rib." And not only does he say no, he tells the master of the eunuchs, he says, "You give us broccoli for a while, and you let the other guys eat the prime rib and come see who's healthier in a matter, you know." Like, and this is coming from a guy that's probably 15 years old, maybe younger. Daniel's a young boy. He's being put into Babylonian school and all that. What? How impressive is that? Did he have the right to refuse the king's prime rib, though? Biblically. Well, yeah, why? Because you said it. Sometimes there's a conflict of authority where God says, do this, and human government says, do this, and they're in conflict, so you have to make a choice, right? And it seems like, and we can think of some other examples, God is saying, you better do what I told you. Okay? John and Peter preaching in Acts 3, and they're told not to preach Jesus anymore. What do? Even after they're flogged. They just preach Jesus, right? Why? Because the U.S. of A. government doesn't have the right to tell us that we can't preach Jesus or that we can't associate collectively in a church. They can arrest us for it. They don't have the right in the law of God. He'll deal with them. But they can do it. Who will take a stand? Peter and John did. They went to prison for it. Others did as well. Right? So we see these examples, and I think there's others. What about that young lady named Esther? Yeah, right? I mean, what did she do? She was, it's great because it's like her cousin, I don't recall who it was, but Mordecai, maybe you were here for such a time as this. But the king had passed a law that said this is how it's going to be and they're going to exterminate the Jews. And she stood against it. Now, just saying, we have a lot of examples like that. So just it seems like the principle would be when man's law tells you you must do what God said not to, or that you can't do what God said you must, you have to choose between God and man. And the Bible says you better choose wisely. Okay. So, any other thoughts? Was it a sin when the midwives, anybody who would take the position that it was a sin when the midwives lied about the Jewish women having their babies too quickly? What do you think? The book I had quoted from a guy last time, Wayne Grudem, has a really outstanding ethics book. It's super thick, but it is worth owning. You can get it as an e-book because it has some chapters I think you'd benefit from, like a whole chapter on climate change and talking about that, or deforestation and capital punishment and stuff. He would say the midwives sinned. And he would go further and he would say that they should not have lied to Pharaoh. And if you press him, well, didn't they save lives? He would say, if they had not lied, God had already purposed to save those children, he would have found another way. There would have been a way that God would have accomplished what he wanted without them lying. And he would say the same thing about Rahab. And I even have a little example here on the handout. Enraged man appears at your door with a gun in his hand and demands, as your husband, your wife, your son, your daughter, are they here? Do you say no? You know they're in the other room. Do you say no? Do you lie? I would. Of course, I usually answer the door when with my own gun in my hand, but I would, even if I didn't have the gun in my hand. And if I do that to protect their safety, is it a sin? See? Anybody have any other comments on that? That's not an easy question, is it? Yeah. Yeah, it's a good comment. That Pharaoh's rule was so evil that he forfeited his right to obedience. I agree with that. Right? That is, and that's the principle that when human government, I believe human government has a delegated authority. I'm not going to try to defend it now, but I think the purpose of human government is to create an environment and try to maintain an environment where righteousness can flourish. And when it becomes evil, and like Pharaoh, where he's put in bondage and in a terrible form of slavery, a bunch of people, he's now killing the firstborns, something we would see Herod do later, killing the babies in Bethlehem. He is certainly in all of that kind of conduct. He is not owed any obedience at all. But they could have simply refused to do his orders instead of lying later. But what they did saved lives. See, it's a thorny problem. Anyway, so my own view is I take the view that I can't tell you this is the right view. Just you know where I'm coming from. I would disagree with Grudem. I think that there are times when you will be put to do something that God would, in the Scripture, would say don't do, like lie. And if it's for something like saving a life, I think it's the right thing to do. I come to that conclusion because I never see God make a negative comment about Rahab lying, the midwives lying, or anybody else. Rahab finds herself in Hebrews 11 in the Hall of Faith. Okay, that's my view. Grudem would say, when the man shows up at your door and he has that gun and he says, are they here? You should not lie. There will be some other option. It may be something else you can say that's truthful. It may be that God will just present something else that makes it, the police all, show up behind him or whatever. But that would be how he would argue it. And then, as I say, some would just say, yes, it's a lie, but you've chosen the lesser lie. And, that has some appeal. Yes, sir.
Yeah, with Pua and Shipra, or even, someone coming to your door like that, there's this, particularly I think of Pua and Shipra, there's this matter of conscience, we cannot kill these babies just because he told us to do it. I mean, your conscience comes to bear on this, and it's just not a question. You're not going to do it. You're not going to do it. And it does. It put them in that rock and the hard spot, and they lied about it. But I don't think that later in the day that the two were sitting at the local bar talking about what had happened. I said, maybe we ought not be lying to him. I just don't think that's the thing that's bearing on their conscience at the end of the day. I don't think they're. Boy, we're saving lives, but boy, I feel so bad we're lying.
Yeah.
That's just kind of a.
No, it's a good point. Like, it's very unlikely that Pua and Shipra ever occurred to them that they had done something wrong. They had risked their lives and saved lives. And this problem of telling the truth is just introduced here because I think almost all of us, one way or another, we're not going to kill the babies. One way or another, we're not going to the man that shows up at the door with a gun in his hand, we're not going to tell him, oh yeah, our family's over here. We're going to do something, whether we lie to him or try to fight him or whatever we do. But it shows you how the ethics questions aren't always that easy. And it's picking an easy example because it seems like a small thing, maybe even a white lie because it saved lives. But then when you get to capital punishment, now we've upped the ante on the ethics question. Yes, sir.
That question would have more weight. By telling that lie, it's the only thing that makes me sin.
Yeah, you said that it would have more weight if you're telling that lie is the only thing that made you a sinner?
Should I do it or not? Just say a lie. But the problem is, I'm a sinner all the time. That little lie in there is not going to matter in the grand scheme of it.
I hear what you're saying. So, will it make a difference in the grand scheme of things, that lie? I don't know, right? I get what you're saying. We've all done far worse things we wouldn't want to share publicly. But then there's that thing where Jesus said every idle word's going to be judged. Even that one, maybe, right? So, anyway, this is just a challenge of thinking. And however you come out on it, I'd be surprised to find anyone who, even Wayne Grudem, wouldn't say, Pua and Shipra were bad. He believes there would have been another option. There was another option for the Tim Bone family other than lying about the Jewish people they were hiding. There was another option for Rahab, and there'd be another option when the enraged man shows up at your door. What about capital punishment? capital punishment. I ask a few hard questions here. I know what the political response is, at least among conservatives, which is put them in the express lane, right? And I get that. And people do horrid crimes. I got asked years ago with a team of other people. A federal judge asked us to work on a death penalty case. The person already had the death penalty. The question was whether there had been an error made so that it should be life in prison. By all accounts, this young person had just the worst upbringing you can imagine. I mean, just as bad as it can get. Family-wise, father had died young while he was very young from AIDS, as I recall. Just all kinds of bad things, abuse. To get $20 from his neighbor, who seems to be the one person that showed care for him, and she was maybe 80 years old, he wrapped an extension cord around her neck and killed her. And got the $20 for the hit of cocaine. And he got a death benefit, or death penalty. There are organizations, of course, and then a lot of people who would oppose the death penalty in all circumstances, including that one. And there's a lot of other people who would say, well, I mean, that guy deserves the chair, or whatever, however you think about it. Does it enter your thinking if his mental intellect is on a seventh grade level? Does it enter your thinking if, you know, if the evidence of the abuse as a child was such severe physical abuse? I'm not telling you how to answer. I'm just telling you to get beyond a political response, get beyond an easy, flippant response, and really think about the things that come in. If you were on that jury in Texas, and if you were properly instructed, you would be told you have to consider those things. You would have to raise your hand and tell the judge, I am willing to have an open mind and consider those things in deciding whether or not this person would get the death penalty. So I want to talk about this capital punishment a little bit. Quickly, I'm not going to go read them all, but I've listed here the passages that are probably relevant to capital punishment. And I've got some passages in the second bullet under number two that people go to who don't support capital punishment. I thought I should read at least the Genesis one. I won't read let me skip Genesis. Let me read Romans 13. You should get a flavor for this. But in Genesis, after the flood is over, God tells Noah that basically anyone who kills another person, because they are made in the image of God, they're going to lose their own life. And the suggestion is that God will do the work of that. That, in other words, it's not an open invitation for vengeance. In fact, later in the law, there would be refugee cities and things like that. But not a thing for vengeance. Just God says, I'm going to do that. And it would seem somewhat apparent that in the unfolding of history, God does that through human government. Romans 13 is the primary text. Another one's in 1 Peter. For this matter of the role of human government, how a Christian ought to think about human government, I just want to read the first seven verses. Paul spends the first eight chapters doing his theology. Chapters 9 through 11, he deals with the question as a parenthetical about why so many Jewish people rejected Christ, and does Israel have a future? Then in 12, the rest of the book, he's very application-oriented. So here he goes, let everyone submit to the governing authorities. But I didn't vote for them. I don't even like the ones I did vote for. And I especially don't like the Internal Revenue Service. Governing authorities, you can put in IRS, okay? Even the Texas Department of Wildlife. You got to pay to go fishing. I mean, what's that about, right? What does he say? Submit to the governing authorities. But they put speed limits. Why is the speed limit 70 and I got a truck go 115? Should I obey it? Is it a sin when I drive over 70 and I know the speed limit's 70 and I just do it anyway because I want to get there faster? Paul says it is. Let everyone submit to governing authority since there's no authority except from God. When did Jesus say that? He said something almost just like that. Remember? He had a little conversation with a Roman proconsul or a procurator, Pontius Pilate. Nobody has any authority except that which come down from above, right? Jesus said the same thing. Because sometimes people say, well, this is Paul talking. You need to listen to Jesus. I did listen to Jesus. He said God's the one that's the source of all authority. Well, what does he say? The authorities that exist are instituted by God. Our government, but that's easy because we kind of like our government because we believe in democracy, even though when God set up a government in Israel, there was no democracy at all. But what about the government in Iran? There are Christians in Iran. When they read this, you understand how they're applying it? Everyone submit to the government in Iran, because that's where they're citizens. That's their obligation. See, this becomes really hard. So then the one who resists the authority is opposing God's command. That's not good, right? And then he goes on and says, those who oppose it will bring judgment on themselves. We call that a speeding ticket. But it could get worse, right? He says, for rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Do you want to be unafraid of the one in authority? Do what's good, and you will have its approval. That's a general statement. For it's God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, because it, human government, does not carry the sword. This isn't a dagger. It's not a pocket knife. It's the sword used, like in the book of Acts, when the sword was used to kill the apostle James. Okay, this is the executioner's sword. It's a particular word, a makaria. He says they do not carry the, as I'm going to read it this way, executioner's sword for no reason. For it's God's servant and avenger that brings wrath on the one who does wrong. Therefore, you must submit, not only because of the wrath, that is, you don't want to lose your head or get a speeding ticket, but also because of your conscience. Okay, this is how I feel about right and wrong between me and God. And for this reason, oh, like he knew what I was thinking. For this reason, you what? Oh, pay taxes. Paul's gone too far. At this point, we've done voted him out of the church. We're going to get us a preacher that tells us we ain't got to pay taxes. You think that's funny? I went to a big Christian thing one time. It was when the Astrodome was still open. There were a ton of people. And there was pastors up there saying, you have no legal obligation to pay your taxes in this country. That sounds hip and cool, and it's political. I get it, but it ain't Bible. And a pastor who tells his people to sin is the worst you can get. He says the authorities are God's servants. So having said that, let's think through this a little bit. We'll probably have to finish up death penalty the next time. But it seems like God, it's hard to say he's against the death penalty, because throughout the law of Moses, there's different offenses that impose a death penalty, like talking back to your parents. We've gotten rid of that one now. The children are happy. But you understand, if God imposes a death penalty in his system of law for the people, if Genesis 9, right after the flood, talks about murderers, at least, being killed, Romans 13, the Roman government or whichever government you're under, doesn't hold the executioner's sword in vain, it seems like there's a case for capital punishment. Somebody push back on me. Tell me why we shouldn't execute our citizens in this country.
What confuses me is Romans 12:2, where it puts it back on us to determine what is right or good or acceptable.
Yeah, right. Romans 12:2, he said, talks about not being conformed to the world, being transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you can determine what is, but it's your good and acceptable service. And it's the word used for when you worship at the temple. It's the way in which our life, but you're right. Like, if I should do that, then how does that affect what I do if I'm on that jury? Whatever the other people do, I'm going to account for myself before God. Paul would say that. We'll all stand before God and give an account. Let me ask you this. You think it would, is it ever morally okay for the US of A government or the Texas government to execute one of its citizens for a crime of murder?
Well, Genesis tells us if you shed the blood of man, your blood will be shed.
That's right. That's exactly. That's the Genesis 9 passage. Okay. So, and someone else, I heard of you. I just wasn't looking. Someone else? Yeah?
I take
it. Yeah. And it's hard to avoid that the Bible makes that case. And I'll say it this way, in principle, that is, I mean, it's pretty clear here, right? Like the sword, the executioner's sword. Peter even says something very similar in 1 Peter, but just to move forward. Is there a time when it's not okay to execute someone who is a murderer?
Yeah.
They may not have a grandson that's going to serve a policy. Some things he understands clearly, I mean, perfectly. And other things, he doesn't, he sees only the good, which of course is good, but he doesn't ever clearly see the evil.
Yeah.
And it could, but it could have been the reverse. He would see everything as evil and bad. And,
right. No, it's a good example, and it's the reason I'm pressing the question, because I think it's easy to say, yes, execute the murderer, but like the issue you've raised, what about mental capacity? Under our law, murder is not when at the last moment someone jots across the road in front of you, you hit them with your car. Now, if you're drunk, we have something called negligent homicide and things like that. But murder it has to have an intent. And when you talk about death penalty, it's often a premeditated intent. You don't have to premeditate it 3 days in advance, but you have planned out this killing, you know. And then the question becomes, does a person that's mentally on a fifth grade level, let's say, even though they might be 40 and they have the strength of a 40-year-old man, do they have the ability to form that intent at all? And even if they do, is it the same as someone who I don't know the best way to say it, but they have, you know, full capacity, you know, and don't have whatever the special challenges are? Right? Now, the law comes down and says you can consider some of these things, but I mean, what do you think?
Somebody that murders somebody, do they have the full capacity? I mean, it's a hard decision to think of. But in the Old Testament, God set up the laws that, you know, I mean, we can look at it, and some of the people, why were they really put to death? They didn't do such a bad thing.
Right.
If we carried out today, most of us would
well, no, but that's a good point. So in this reason, we have to be careful about appealing to the law of Moses. Yes, God imposed the death penalty, but I mentioned an example earlier. One of them was for children who essentially are rebellious to their parents. And I could argue reasons why that was the way it was at that moment. We don't do that here, although maybe some people think we should, right? People have different views. We kill people in this country in terms of the government doing it for a crime, for two crimes. Murder, what's the other one? Do y'all know? Treason. Yeah, someone said it, treason. And that's the federal government can execute you for treason, you know, sharing secret papers and, you know, whatever. But we don't, as a general matter, execute people for stealing. Now understand, if you're stealing, you're the getaway driver at the bank, and your buddy that went in there to rob the teller shoots the teller, you in the getaway car can be, certainly can spend life in prison and possibly could be executed. It's called felony murder. But I mean, as a general matter though, if you haven't killed somebody, you can beat them, steal from them, rape them, almost anything. You will not, there's not even a system set up to give you the death penalty in this country. Maybe people would disagree. I have that question on here. I think I asked this. I mean, you know, do you think that capital punishment is appropriate for something other than murder?
Horse
thieving, right? I hear you. Well, yes, ma'am.
One of them, it used to be there. Capital punishment for drug dealers. Mm-hmm. And they
It's a great one. Should there be capital punishment for drug dealers who put their poison into the system knowing children will die from that? I think I can make a pretty good argument for that. We don't do that, but you know what I'm saying. But again, I've got to tie it down to the scripture and decide if you know, when the scripture says thou shalt not murder, sixth commandment, it's a unique word. It's never used in the Old Testament of people who kill in war. It's used of an unlawful taking of a human life. Is selling a poison, maybe fentanyl, to 15-year-olds, knowing that there's a reasonably good likelihood they'll be seriously injured if not killed, should that draw a death penalty? Should it draw at least some kind of murder charge, even if it's just manslaughter? Right? Manslaughter is like unintentional murder.
If we were to review that, then domestic violence laws haven't changed in over 80 years.
Yeah.
So a felony drug charge requires a penalty of prison time right now, whereas a felony domestic violence charge can give you probation. So if we're going to do that, we need to look at everything in retrospect.
Well, and that's a good point. We have a, because the drug issue became so political, you have federal crimes against it because it's considered to implicate, you know, national commerce. And there's federal sentencing guidelines that are often are very stiff, but we've taken sort of this strong hand. Now, it's not the death penalty, but, you know, and then other crimes that in some ways are even maybe more serious, like domestic abuse, which often ends, even if there's a restraining order and that kind of stuff, with somebody dying. I had somebody not, you know, it's just been 20 years ago, but in my Sunday school class, and it wasn't until she was almost dead in the hospital that something got done. And she almost died. Yeah. Well, and you're right, and the walls aren't very severe, and you know, and of course, that person, if they eventually kill the other person, the abuser kills someone, they could get a death penalty. So there is always this general issue of, well, you know, how do we deal with different areas of the law? Let me give you a couple of thoughts as we close about this. We can talk some more about it next time. And I have a little insight here just because of my vocation. In fact, I had read, I have some statistics here. This is in this technical paper. Like I said, if you want to go pull it up on the website, I'll make sure it's there. Actually, I have a link to this under number 2. There's a bullet that says for a technical article, and it gives you a web address to my website, and it's got a lot of articles. It's got this one. At the end of 2018, 34 states and the federal government authorized the use of capital punishment for certain types of murder, i.e. first-degree murder, which is premeditated. And then in the case of the federal government for treason, we mentioned that earlier. In 2018, 2,628 prisoners were on death row, and there were 25 executions. And I add, and I said this, and I've got some authority cited, there can be little doubt that innocent people have been executed. In the old days, and frankly not that long ago, during some people's lifetimes, they were executed because they were black. And they got arrested, but for other reasons as well. The Innocence Project, an organization that uses DNA to exonerate prisoners, reports that since 1989, there have been 375 prisoners exonerated through DNA evidence. This often, it could be like a rape case or something, or some other case where the only evidence, I'm going to give you an example, and it's one I worked on. It was out in Livingston, Texas. There was a hair fiber. He had already been executed, and largely on the evidence that the hair fiber was his. The government fought tooth and nail to keep it from having DNA testing because DNA testing wasn't around at the time of the arrest. And, of course, when they tested it, it wasn't his hair fiber. Right? That's the kind of thing that they're talking about. So there's been 375 prisoners exonerated, 21 of whom were on death row for what they did. Their primary thing is DNA. The DNA evidence just opened up a whole new thing. And the reason I mention this is just to say, we don't always get it right, okay? We don't always get it right. And so I ask the question here, do you think capital punishment is acceptable if we get it right about 95% of the time?
I don't think that's a justification.
In what way, what's not a justification?
So it could be even another, but not that, not because it's we almost get it right, then we should keep doing or sustaining killing people. Like with the Nazis, they were using people to develop health improvements against their will. Is that the reason? Is that okay? Oh, this guy, he's going to die anyway, so let me use him.
Yeah. So you would say 95% is not good enough. Like if we're going to kill our citizens, we ought to have a better track record than 95%.
I'm not saying.
You're saying the opposite. You're saying even if we're wrong 5% of the time, then that's unfortunate that we're wrong 5% of the time. But you know there still has to be a punishment that fits the crime of murder or whatever else. Is that?
No, actually, no.
Okay.
I'm saying I would consider if it would be 100%, okay, well, let's talk about it. But if it's not, that's not a reason good enough to go ahead with that.
Okay, okay. So the one last thing I'll throw into the, just so you can kind of leave with this thought in mind about it, is I don't know what the percentage is, but we know it's not 100%. We know we don't get it right all the time. Who represents the people who are on who are facing getting a death penalty? Who are their lawyers? Sometimes they have money. There was this clown out in Galveston that just seems to relish in murdering people, and I can't remember his name. He's a rich guy, and he's close to 90 years old now, but he's gotten off of several murder raps because he has good counsel. Okay? If you don't have money, and most Americans would struggle to afford an attorney on a death penalty case, it's extraordinarily expensive. But the state will get you a lawyer in Texas for about $100 an hour. My rate's $500 an hour. I sat down and had a lunch, and this was 15 years ago, with a criminal attorney, a good one, who practiced with someone that's a guy that's on the news all the time, George Parnum, at least in the old days he was. And he said, you know, I require a $25,000 check first visit. Otherwise, we're not talking. And he said, I get appointed as counsel about once a year. Now, this was, again, 15 years ago. But he says, I get $300 a day. He said, I can't run my office for an hour at $300. But I have to do it because the judge makes them do it. But he does one a year. And he just said to me, what kind of counsel do you think people are getting for $300 a day when they're up on for death penalty? Something to think about. I'll suggest to you they're getting what they pay for. Okay. But if the U.S. Constitution, and it does, guarantees you the right to effective assistance of counsel, and if you're getting someone who isn't going to pay much attention because they're getting paid 20 or 15% of the going rate, now are we satisfying the constitutional obligation ordained in Romans 13? Our human government rests on that constitution that promises effective assistance of counsel. Well, I'll leave it there. Just think about that. Yeah, it's a hard issue. But let's pray.